From the heart of the Forest City, Blackburn Media presents the Craig Needles Podcast, looking at the biggest stories in London and around the world and how they impact you. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
Another episode of the Craig Needles Podcast here in a new week, our Tuesday episode. I want to talk provincial politics today. That's what we're looking at. We'll get to a couple other things as far as, you know, COVID restrictions and whatnot later on. But I want to start by talking about provincial politics, which invariably means that we are going to have to talk about COVID restrictions and school closures and things along those lines. But to do that with us today, we are joined by Fanshawe College politics professor Matt Farrell, who is on the line with us to discuss the provincial politics situation. Matt, thank you very much for doing this. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Craig.
So first, your take on where Doug Ford and company are at right now, because I look at some of the polls that we've got recently and I've seen them at 30% approval rating, 29% approval rating, enough in that zone that it seems to be real, that people in this province are not approving of his job performance. Does that mean that he has no chance coming up in June, or does that mean that they're going to have to sort of wait and see, or are things changing fast enough that we don't know, in your opinion?
I think it's definitely a spot where he is maybe starting to get worried. And, you know, you mentioned the polling over the past few weeks. Some of it coming out has not been great for the premier, especially that recent one from Angus Reid that had him at, I think, 30%. A lot of them had him around 35, but that was a new low for that one. And, you know, I'm just not sure where that puts him. Is that good enough? Can you win with 30 to 35% without really a viable alternative yet? And I'm not convinced yet that the Liberals are a viable alternative. But I think that there are some reasons for Ford to be optimistic. When you kind of dig into the numbers a bit, and there's, you know, the Angus Reid ones most recently, and then a couple of weeks ago, the in-house polling from Strategic Council that got leaked, and that really did not look good. That was the sort of folks that kind of, you know, just a general gradual decline in the folks that thought he was doing a good job. But when you unpack it a bit, in the Angus Reid survey, there was, you know, 19% that said he had a good job with rapid tests. That's not great. But 65% thought he did a good job with vaccines. And so if you've got general approval rating that's on the decline, but you've still got, you know, a super majority of folks that you're doing a good job on this one thing, vaccine distribution, that happens to be a very important thing, and it was a very important thing in the recent federal election. So that tells me there's still some cushion there. There's still some folks that maybe might, you know, reflexively give a disapproved response just based on, you know, maybe these are kind of red Tory voters that tend Liberal. But that is the sign that I think he's got some potential votes, or I think Abacus Data calls them accessible votes. Those are votes that he could get. And, you know, even the, Innovative Research had some, you know, really good breakdown of the different demographic groups. And, you know, the Time for a Change had him at about 50%. 50% of the voters wanted a Time for Change. That still could be okay. You know, if you've got no clear alternative, both opposition parties hovering around, you know, 30%-ish themselves, you know, maybe that's good enough for you. And he was even in some key demographic groups, he was still the best choice for premier, and the sort of business Liberal groups and some of those demographic subcategories that Innovative Research likes to create. The small sample size, that one was only 500 people, but still, that's, I think if you can get past that, overall, do you like Doug Ford? Do you think he's doing a good job? And would you vote for him again? I think there's a lot more room there than the kind of top line approval, disapproval.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting part. And I think that people saying, oh, well, Doug Ford is not going to get reelected. I think that they are missing a couple of key things. One, for the most part in the pandemic, we've seen governments be returned to office, be it federally, be it in other provinces, that when there's an election, whoever was in charge before the election is typically still in charge when the election is done. So there's that element of it. There's also the fact that, you know, where are you going to get the seats that the Progressive Conservatives have? And there are a lot of these seats that they won by such huge margins that even if confidence in Doug Ford has been chipped away, it may not make much of a difference. So there's that math that's part of it as well for me.
Absolutely. And I mean, I would probably peg that around 30 to 40 seats that they could mail in today. Yep. that are going to be just fine. And so then you're only, about, 15 realistically toss up seats away from a majority government. So I do think that there's the geography plays a factor as well. And in the, we've had two federal elections since we've had the last provincial one. And one of the things that has really been evident in those results is the density divide. Zach Taylor over at Western does some good research on this, but the sort of urban-rural split, the vote share by density, was at its highest level in the last federal election. So what does that mean for the provincial map? And I don't know if it means there's a lot of room to change. You know that the Liberals are going to be strong around Ottawa and do all right in the GTA. The PCs are going to have a pretty strong foothold in the sort of rural Southwest, and the 905 NDP's got, sort of their Niagara, Hamilton region, and then the kind of the cities in the Southwest. So there's a lot of stuff there that I think is a function of, geography and population density, where there might not be as many toss-up seats to move around. And if you're the NDP, I don't think you're overly happy as the NDP right now when you've taken a look at the recent results coming from the federal election and you see only five federal seats. That's not good. You're looking at your 40 plus seats provincially. You think you're in good shape. You're in striking distance. That can't feel good when you see that your support has been confined to the, to those urban areas in a few geographic locations. And I know I'm pretty sure, back in 2018, we had talked about how many of these votes were actually true NDP votes provincially, or they were votes that were just being parked there because they were anti-Kathleen Wynne votes. Not sure where those are going to go. So I don't know if I'm too confident right now if I'm the NDP.
What you have going for you via the NDP, and we can talk about their fortunes more specifically now, is you have the advantages of incumbency in a lot of these ridings that the Liberals will not. And how much does that translate to, the party I like best is the Liberals, but then you get to the ballot box and you think to yourself, well, I kind of, this MPP has been pretty good, so I'm going to vote for that person again. And I think of ridings like London North Centre that were Liberal strongholds forever, currently New Democrat. And I think of ridings in downtown Toronto where they voted Liberal forever and ever and ever, and now all of a sudden they win NDP. Well, wait, hold on a second. Maybe they like having a New Democrat MPP there. So there's going to be that consideration as well as the advantage of incumbency for the NDP in those seats where it's not the Progressive Conservatives that are going to be coming after them, it's the Liberals.
And to be fair, you're quite right. To be fair to some of those Liberal seats around Toronto federally, the second place finisher was the NDP. So right. They do have some potential. They've got a pool of votes there that's ready to be organized and to pulled out on election day. You mentioned incumbency, and that's a huge part of it. A big part of when you're looking at provincial politics, a very small percentage of people that can actually name their member of provincial parliament. Incumbency matters because that often translates into the name you recognize on the ballot or the name you recognize on the signs. So that can go a long way for sure. And I do think a lot of what we're, the sentiment that's expressed in the polls right now, a lot of it is, are you happy right now? And, I don't think many folks are, especially coming out of a couple weeks of homeschooling after Christmas. People are not going to be happy right now. How does that affect vote choice and partisan lean as things improve? I'm optimistic. I'm making the assumption that things are going to improve, but as things improve, how does that change? Do you become more confident, maybe even complacent, happy enough, you're satisfied with the current premier that you'd be willing to vote for him again, less likely to seek an alternative? I think that's going to be a big part of it. One positive for the NDP, though, is that many of the things that folks are unhappy about, namely education and things about getting kids back to school and protections for teachers and all that, that's right into the NDP wheelhouse. So that sort of support with the teachers union, protection of workers, that is an issue that they will feel comfortable fighting an election about. So that they've got that going for them. Conversely, I don't know if the Liberals necessarily have one of those right now. For them, the 2018 campaign was disastrous. And so they need to ask themselves, what are they going to be fighting about? What is this next election going to be about? And I'm not sure they're really there yet. I don't know if they've figured out how they're going to position themselves, what is going to be their issue. It's a little tough to tell right now with just, you know, in the middle of this wave with people just getting back to school. But I think that's something that they need to be concerned about, especially given the fact that the Liberal numbers have been all over the place, as low as 25, as high as 36. The Innovative Research poll, I don't know where that one came from, but I'm really not sure what's going on with the Liberal support right now.
And I'm not sure either, because when Stephen Del Duca was picked as the leader, I sort of wondered, hey, what's your plan? Because Ontarians pretty roundly rejected the McGuinty Wynn Liberals. They decided, okay, we've had enough of you. You guys have got to go. And they went down to 7 seats. Now, despite that, they're in a situation where, again, polling sometimes looks pretty good. So how are they turning the page from the McGuinty Wynn era to the Del Duca era? Is that even possible? I suppose that's one of the things they're going to have to try and do, because maybe the pandemic, it's possible, would have kind of erased the memories of some of the negative stuff that happened in the Wynn and the McGuinty eras, and Ontarians are ready to vote for the Liberal Party again. But there's that kind of hanging over this, is they had some poor results almost 4 years ago now. Have they done enough to change the party to have an alteration to those poor results?
And it was a disaster.
It was awful.
when you think about that election. I think the reason the conservative leadership was so hotly contested, and for a span of a couple of years, you know, going back to the Patrick Brown stuff, it was so hotly contested because the person was going to win. Whoever was the leader of that party was going to win, because there was just a rampant and widespread dissatisfaction with the Wynn government. And the challenge, you're quite right, is how to rebrand yourself. Especially when you're looking at somebody that, you know, was in that orbit as a decision maker in that government. Can you detach yourself? Can you come up with a framing that works in the minds of voters? And it's not, I don't think it would be sufficient to say, you know, to organize your campaign around, hey, this guy's done a poor job. Because I don't know if that sales pitch is going to land. Maybe it will in a few months once we get closer to summertime, depending on when this election ends up getting called. But I don't think that that's a winning formula, because when I unpack some of this stuff, some of the polling data, there's enough folks that do think the government is doing a good enough job. And so I don't know if that's a winning recipe for them. I think for the Ford government, that's going to be their counterattack, is this is just the same old Wynn government reincarnated. And I feel like that is going to have some tact. That's going to stick with them. So, how do you position yourselves as an alternative? How do you brand yourself aside from saying, man, don't you hate this guy in power? Can't we get rid of him? Because I do think from the issue perspective, with the focus on education and worker protection and all that, that sort of plays more to an NDP strength. So I still feel like we would end up somewhere around a very close to a majority / minority PC government. And I don't know what we'd be looking at with the other two parties, or, you know, hovering around 30 seats each at this point would be my guess. So I don't know if we'd get a majority government, and I'm not sure that the Liberals would necessarily be the opposition. You know, the NDP still could be within striking distance unless the Liberals can maybe find a way to craft a narrative about the leader that is one you can win an election with.
Yeah, that's the fascinating part for me. And the other thing that I wonder about is, you know, Andrea Horvath, this will be kick at the can 4 for her. Is this going to be number 4? She did not find a way to become premier when she was up against a scandal-plagued Kathleen Wynne and Doug Ford, who had very, very significant numbers on the approval-disapproval side. You either loved him or hated him. This has to be the last go-round for her. Is this the time she can win, or do you think that this particular train has already left the station for her?
Again, it's a tough one. I do think that if they were going to feel positive about potential and momentum, I think they would have wanted a few more seats in the last federal election. That would have been some evidence of happiness with the party brand, or maybe just a desire for something different than the Liberals. So I don't think that that's something that they're overly happy about. But as a leader, you know, official opposition status, that is a positive. And in NDP land, that's in Ontario anyway, that's kind of a victory. So I think there's enough satisfaction with her in the caucus and the party base that she might get another kick of the can. I'm not sure she'd want to, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how long you want to do this for as a leader, and you do want to start thinking about renewal and succession and trying to position the party. If this is your ceiling, you know, if this is where you're going to max out as sort of, you know, being in the opposition, then maybe it is time. Maybe it is time to try and think about reinvigorating the party. Jagmeet Singh, you know, decent job of that, of trying to really target the younger voters. And, you know, maybe that's something they need to do as well. I think part of the NDP challenge with her leader or otherwise is just the labor movement. You know, we're seeing a kind of schism in the labor movement, if you want to think of it that way, where you're seeing professional unions like teachers unions, for example, align pretty strongly with the NDP, but traditional sort of, you know, manufacturing workers and that sort of traditional aspect of the labor movement, you're starting to see some of them align more with the Conservative Party. So I don't know if that's the base of the party that they have maybe relied on in past decades. I think it's going to look somewhat different, and maybe that means a new approach with a new leader. I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I'm fascinated as to what it means. And here's the thing: we're sitting here analyzing these poll numbers. What will voters do? I think there are a couple things, or more than a couple things, we don't know yet. One, what does our COVID-19 situation look like in June, or well, less so June, but more so May. And mm-hmm. The other thing is, will there be? And you mentioned, like, okay, if the you know parties wind up with 30 seats each type of thing, I think that'd be fascinating and super fun for us in the media.
Absolutely.
But will there be a desire of voters to coalesce behind one of the non-Ford options, be it the Liberals, be it the NDP? And we're not quite sure about that either, because polls are going back and forth, and we won't know until we're in the middle of a campaign if that's going to happen, in my opinion.
Yeah, way too early to tell. And it does. I mean, in some ridings, it will be a bit of a coordination problem. You could have as many as 10 ridings where you get the Liberals and the NDP splitting the vote. So yeah, without an obvious alternative, that could be the opportunity there for the PCs to eke out a couple of seats. You know, back to geography, that is a huge one. Can a couple of those seats in the GTA and you know hold on to them. I think that's going to be a challenge, and you're quite right. We don't know right now what the context is going to be. You've got the premier sticking to his brand and shoveling people out of the snow. I mean, that's from that perspective, he hasn't changed a bit. That's been his brand. He's going to stick with that. And you know, I a lot of folks upset about that. A lot of people happy about that. I asked them, you know, how they would react when Kathleen Wynne was doing the same thing. Would they have the same reaction, or is it just a reflexive partisanship? That's his thing. He's good at that thing. He has been, you know, at times criticized of not being the best communicator in terms of policy. You know, you get the sort of the pre-announcement of an announcement and the leak and so on. That irked a lot of parents, I'm sure. So here, I think that context is going to be everything, what the landscape looks like at election time and how people are feeling about that. Are they feeling genuinely positive? Is that their outlook? Is that the sentiment they're going to carry into the voting booth? Or is it one of anger and frustration and desire for change?
Yeah, that's the big question, is what's that going to look like? And the answer is we don't know. Matt, I know you've got class coming up, so I'm going to let you go because we've got there's tons more we can talk about, but sadly the clock is working against us. Anything else that you're going to be watching closely over the next couple of weeks before we wrap up here that you want to pass along to us?
I think I just want to see the how the public reacts to Del Duca, but also how the Liberals position him. I want to see how they're able to present him as a choice for voters. It's difficult. I know it's, you know, it's challenging to get out canvassing and meeting folks, but how do the Liberals position themselves as an alternative? Can they run a campaign that's framed in a way that presents a positive vision for governing that's something more than, man, don't you hate this other guy? To me, that will be interesting because they're rapidly running out of time here. We're going to be into the spring before we know it, and then things will kick into high gear. So whatever they're going to do, they need to do it quick. So I'll be watching how they, you know, just their general comms plan, but also how the public reacts. That I'll be looking to see some more polling around that. I mean, that 36% that innovative research at the Liberals, I'm not convinced at that one. I want to see some more numbers before I'm convinced that they're making some traction. But that's what I'll be looking for.
Yeah, it's a good thing to look at. Well, we'll leave it there. Matt, thanks as always for this. Good to talk to you. Good to catch up. And we'll I'm sure be chatting with you soon.
Likewise, Craig. Thank you.
That's Matt Farrell, politics professor at Fanshawe College here on the Craig Needles podcast. We are going to talk with an old friend of mine, former city councilor Cheryl Miller, after we take a very brief pause here on the podcast. So stick with us. It is the Craig Needles podcast. You can find us on londonnewstoday.ca, classicrock981.com, and of course, on all your major podcatchers on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and so forth. We are back on the Craig Needles podcast with the aforementioned, promised, and legendary former city councilor Hollywood Cheryl Miller. Hello, Cheryl. Thank you very much for doing the podcast. Looking forward to talking politics with you.
And I'm just polished up my crystal ball, so I'm ready to go.
All right, good. I'm glad. I was just talking to Matt Farrell, and we were saying, hey, it might be too soon to tell on some of the stuff, but I wanted to get your take on how you think the Ford government is situated right now, because we've seen some polling data that would tell us consistently here, we're talking about approval ratings in the very low 30s or high 20s in some cases. And that's not just one or two outlier polls. That's sort of been the consistent theme here. Do you think they're in a lot of trouble? What do you think their spot is right now?
Well, I think that Ford's in an elevator and it's in a free fall, and he's pushing the buttons by going out and shoveling people out and by driving people. He's trying to restore some kind of faith in him. But I'm telling you, as a Tory, I'm not sure, but I'm quite sure he'll win the election. But by how much? That's the whole problem. He can put himself into a minority and just completely handcuff himself.
And if he's in a minority, there could be a situation. And look, I know it's a long shot, but there could be a situation where the opposition party decided to form some sort of coalition. That's something that's on the table here if it's a minority government. I really believe that.
Yeah, and that scares me because I don't have any respect for Andrea Horvath whatsoever. I wish she had one original idea and went with it, but in fact, she's against everything. And Stephen Del Duca is old yesterday's news, and Kathleen Wynne's. He's brought nothing fresh. If we'd had a different leader, and I'm thinking of Kate Graham, she might have actually moved this Liberal Party provincially forward. But and the Green Party, which annoys me whenever he's interviewed, because he's a party of one and has absolutely no clout at this government. So what's the alternative? I think people are going to have to look at that during the election, is what's the alternative and what are their platforms? Because Andrea will just regurgitate the same stuff. And Del Duca, who knows? I don't know what his platform is going to be.
Yeah, and those are the questions I have, is about the competition, less so Ford himself. Because we look back to when Kathleen Wynne stayed on as premier in 2018 after Dalton McGuinty left and she took over. Everyone kind of thought, oh, okay, this is the end of the ride, the end of the road for the Ontario Liberals. Horvath or Hudak, one of them is going to take over. And that's not the way this went down, because the people of the province said, no, actually, we're fine with Wynne. And I wonder if Doug Ford may wind up in a similar situation, depending, again, on the quality of the opposition. And I agree with you entirely that the Ontario Liberal Party would be better off if Kate Graham was their leader, or Michael Coteau, one of them. And hey, maybe I'm going to wind up being wrong about that, but I feel as though their electoral results would have been improved with one of those two people at the helm of the party. But now we're in a situation where we may wind up seeing Doug Ford get back in, and it might be a pretty similar looking legislature to the one we have right now.
Yeah, I think people are going to look the lesser of all the evils. And Ford, I mean, he's done some good things. The problem I have with him, and I think it's just me personally, because when I ran, same thing, I don't like to be told what to do. Mm-hmm. And when you've got really bright people like Phillips and Urich, and they leave early, what it signals to me and a number of other people out there is he's not a nice man to work with. I love the styles. I like Jeff Urich's down home, and this is a safe seat. This isn't something that anybody leaves because it's, you know, there's a chance he might lose. This is a safe seat. And the fact that he's resigned says to me that, I've heard from other people too, that he doesn't play nice in the House, and particularly with his caucus. And if Doug Ford wants to be reelected, he has to get the rest of his good people elected. And if he keeps losing them, that's the slippery slope that I see. And that's the one that concerns me. You lose good people and you've got no one to jump in. Fortunately, in London, we've got three good, strong candidates. But who knows? It's going to depend on what Doug's going to do from here on in. And he better smarten up, quite frankly. I'm losing faith in him. Well, I think I've lost it, really.
Yeah, it's not been a good situation from a variety of perspectives. And look, things were not necessarily smooth sailing for this group even before the pandemic hit. Like, they had a rough year and a half before we got to March of 2020. And look, there are some things in the pandemic that I think is fair to say have gone well. I think that they've distributed vaccinations at a rate that is comparable with just about any place else in the world. Good. That's fine. And I think we should be happy about that. But you look at some of the choices they've made surrounding schools and perhaps a lack of proper investment there. Now, one could argue that there were improper investments in education and the quality of school buildings even before Doug Ford became premier, and that's fair to say. But nonetheless, there was not COVID-19 specific investments. Hospital situation, exact same thing. One could argue the Liberals had done a bad job with that, but Doug Ford came in and there weren't enough COVID specific investments when it came to hospital capacity. So these are the types of things that the province as a collective are dealing with, and Ford is going to have to answer for coming up in May and June.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think Doug Ford's done a bad job in this pandemic. What he's done is he's hasn't been firm. I mean, you look at Legault in Quebec. He said, this is what we're going to do, and I'm going to do it. He gets pressure back. He doesn't stop. Ford waffles. If you're going to make a tough decision, make it and stand behind it. I think he's been all over the map with the schools. I believe strongly that you're never going to put enough money into schools. It just simply isn't a mindset to change the system in Ontario so that we're getting the best bang for all of our kids at a reasonable price. That's never going to happen. So we're always going to be fighting this issue with education. But, you know, giving them a week, we're going to take an extra week. What does that do? I have teachers in my family. I have kids that go to school in my family. So what does it do? It does nothing. So that to me was a silly decision that he made. And hospitals, healthcare in this province has been an issue through years and years and years. And we're seeing it now. And one of the things that we're going to have to decide on is, should we be looking at potentially two-tier? Oh my God, everybody's going to scream. You can't have two-tier. Well, maybe we're going to have to look at it, because they're talking, when I read online, they're saying, make the anti-vaxxers pay. If they go to the hospital, they should pay. It's two-tier. Don't mm-hmm. tell me that you don't support two-tier hospitalization. You're suggesting it. So there's so many big decisions that we need to make after this pandemic in both education and healthcare, that we need somebody who's got a vision, who's got a team around them that can make good decisions for the right reasons. One other thing I want to say is one of the problems with electing good people is we elect them and we send them to do there because we trust them. We know they're going to do a good job. But there's all those advisors that have been hanging around for years and years and years that the good people listen to. And oftentimes we're back in the 80s. And, you know, it's ever thus in big government.
Yeah, and I get it. And some of these are lifetime jobs, and you wonder to yourself, hey, wait, should these be lifetime jobs as far as I work in strategy for this party or whatever it happens to be? That's, you know, a different conversation for a different day. What I wonder about, wonder about the future of all of these leaders after the election, because there's a chance that the two that don't win are done for. Like that's the end of the line for them. One could argue, and I think that people have successfully argued this in the past, that the NDP might be in a better situation if they had someone like Catherine Fife or Merritt Stiles, their leader, as opposed to Andrea Horvath. And look, maybe I'll be wrong about that. Maybe Andrea Horvath is going to be the next Premier of Ontario. But would they be in a better position if choices like that were made? It's something that you consider.
We said the same thing after Kathleen Wynne. That's the end of Andrea. She's still hanging in there. She's not going to go anywhere. Unless her party makes a decision for her, she's not going to go anywhere because she's determined to become the leader in Ontario. That never happened.
Yeah. Well, doesn't the party have to make the choice, though, at some point in the very near? Oh. Like, you know, after this election, if she's not the premier, I don't see how you give her a fifth kick at the can. And again, like, she's grown the number of MPPs this party has. And that is a commendable accomplishment if you're talking about becoming the leader of a provincial party that post-Howard Hampton was in a really ugly spot. And they've seen consistent growth since then. Fair enough. But at some point, isn't the goal of this to have an NDP government? And if it is she the person to accomplish that goal? And I don't know. We haven't seen that evidence yet.
No. And it's not about numbers, it's about quality too. So you can put lots of people in there and have just people who keep the seats warm. Right now we need, in this upcoming election, we need dynamic people who are going to go in there and are going to push back on the leaders, are going to push back on the advisors, and are going to make some decisions that really affect this province. We've got such an opportunity after this pandemic and this new election to make significant changes. But the leaders have got to listen to not only their members. And if Stephen Del Duca gets elected, Florida's really starting to look good for me.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see what the real estate listings look like down there.
Hey, good prices.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I'm curious to see what this looks like. And I'll ask you locally before we wrap up here. I know that Paul Pilato is someone who you've worked with before. I think that Peggy Sattler is pretty much unbeatable. You may or may not agree with that. I don't know if anyone else is even trying to win London Fanshawe, and London North Centre, I think, is going to be a hotly contested race just because you've got an incumbent in place. And I think that the Liberal Party of Ontario, or the Ontario Liberal Party rather, is going to be very invested in making sure Kate Graham becomes an MPP. Would you agree with me as far as the looking at the local races from that perspective?
Yeah. You know, the NDP are pretty well entrenched in London, which is unfortunate because the only representative we actually had with this government was Jeff Yurick.
Oh, and, well, he's not going to be around much longer, is he?
No. Interestingly enough, no. He really took London to heart because he only has a small bite of it. What we lose out on is that we don't have anybody at the table in London. And people have to examine that. Peggy Sattler's a great woman, absolutely. And being in opposition, Craig, is so much easier than being in government. So you've got three members who are in opposition who do the same format that Andrea does. The only person that comes forward with any kind of legislation ideas is Peggy. Is she unbeatable? No, I don't think anybody's unbeatable. I really don't.
Okay.
Are people going to have to look at this? They're going to have to look at this election by the leadership. Do they want Andrea, or do they want Stephen, or do they want Ford? That to me is the decision.
That's going to be an awkward situation for some people in this province who would say no thanks to all the above.
Right. So they're going to vote green, which has done nothing. But I don't think they should waste your votes. Don't lose your vote. We're fortunate enough to have it. Be firm. Get involved in the election. I can't tell people enough. It's hard work. It's absolutely an amazing opportunity to get to know the ins and outs and get to know some really good people. So get involved. Vote and participate. It's the only way you change.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, I think that, yeah, voting and participation is definitely something that matters. I'll let you go, Cheryl, just because I'm running out of time here. I'm trying to keep these things relatively brief for the listeners' sake. So thank you so much for doing this. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
Anything I want to say?
Yeah.
No, we don't have enough time.
Fair enough.
But I just want to say, Jeff Preston, congratulations. And yes, I'm going to drag you into something.
Jeff has been getting at Cheryl on Twitter. I got to have Jeff on this podcast soon. Now that he's got tenure, like I said, the guy's untouchable. He's Teflon.
He's an important man. I'll have to listen. You need to have a phone in so some of us can just call him.
All right. Well, I'll talk to Jeff about that. We'll figure it out.
Yeah,
Cheryl, okay, thank you so much for this. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
That's former city councilor Hollywood Cheryl Miller. My thanks to her for doing the Craig Needles podcast with us today, as well as my thanks to Fanshawe College politics professor Matt Farrell. Back with a new episode on Friday, looking at the school situation, the education situation, in a couple of different ways that you may not expect here on the Craig Needles podcast. So hopefully you can tune in coming up on Friday for that episode. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you then.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of Blackburn Media.